Hi, my name is Brendan Malone and you're listening to The Dispatches, the podcast that strives to cut through all the noise in order to challenge the popular narratives of the day with some good old-fashioned contrarian thinking. You might not always agree, but at least you'll be taking a deeper look at the world around you. Hi everybody, welcome along to another episode of The Dispatches. Thanks once again for tuning in. If you're not already a subscriber or a follower of this podcast on whatever platform you're listening on right now, why not hit that little subscribe or follow button so that you get updated every time we publish a new episode, which is several times a week. One other thing, can I just say a huge thank you too to all of our patrons at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. The link is in the show notes for this episode, wherever you're listening. You guys are awesome, and it's thanks to you that today's episode was possible. If you enjoy this content, you're liking the podcast, and you want to hear more of it, then please consider becoming a patron of this podcast, The Dispatches, at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. The link is in the show notes, as I said. And for as little as $1 a month or as much as you'd like to contribute, you can ensure that more of these great episodes keep happening. You guys are awesome. Thanks for all the feedback I'm getting too. Really, really enjoying interacting with everyone. You guys are awesome. Oh, one other thing I should say too is that I'm going to be starting either later this week or next week some special patron-only episodes of the podcast. So these will be episodes that will be available exclusively to patrons. So if you're a subscriber and you are also a supporter of the podcast, you'll be getting some extra content as a little bonus, as a way of saying thank you and value for money and for supporting this little endeavour. Today, I'm going to prove the point that I made last episode, that this is not simply a COVID podcast. And today, we're not going to talk about COVID. We're going to talk about the 11 different types of media bias that you are being exposed to or can be exposed to on a daily basis. So, yeah, I'm really, like I said in the last episode, I didn't want people to get a false impression that this was a podcast solely about COVID. And today, I'm going to prove that point. Now, when we're thinking about media bias, I think one of the things that's really important to start with is that it actually doesn't have to be intentional. And I think this is a common fallacy that people fall into, of thinking that perhaps somehow there is a carpool of journalists or editors who meet together on a Monday morning, perhaps, and they agree about what stories and issues they're going to be biased about this week and which direction their bias is going to go, etc., etc. So it's a sort of very nefarious conspiracy theory of sorts, that in actual fact, to have bias in a story, you don't need any of that. You just don't. It doesn't even have to be intentional. Now, there is intentional bias. I've seen it. And you can see intentional bias creeping in places, but it doesn't have to be intentional. Bias can arise in a couple of ways that have got nothing to do with intention. So regardless of what a journalist or an editor actually intends, this bias can still make its presence felt. And in very powerful ways when it comes to shaping thought and thinking about particular issues that happen to be the issues of the day. So one of those ways this can happen is out of a place of ignorance. So a journalist perhaps doesn't know things, or they don't know as much about an issue or the people they're reporting on, and so out of that ignorance, they might report in a way or report things that are prejudicial or that have a bias to them, but they don't realise that that's the case because they don't realise they're not dealing with all of the facts. I think a more common way this can happen, though, is because of ingrained bias. So you've got an ingrained perspective or bias on the world that you... Now, I'm using that word bias. It often gets used in a very negative way, but just the way you lean, the way... That's really what I'm thinking about here. The way you view the world, the way you look at the world, your vision of reality is the particular lens through which you look at things. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about your bias. And so you've got people, for example, in the modern mainstream media environment where the vast majority of people are left-leaning. Often now it's not uncommon for them to actually be progressive, very progressive in their views. And you're sort of interacting within a very closed community of people who share the same political views most of the time. You are bouncing off ideas off each other. To be in the media is a sort of a communal job in a sense. It's got like a vocational sort of sense to it, not just a, a career calling, if you like. There's a sense of doing something important. The people involved are often a very tight-knit group of people who work odd hours and who socialise with each other and who sort of live, in a sense, in a world of their own a lot of the time in their professional careers. That's a little bit unique from other types of careers. And so if that's your situation, it's very easy to fall into an echo chamber. And it's very easy if you have a, let's say you're very progressive in your politics, or even, you know, mildly progressive in your politics. First of all, what's going to happen is, especially when you're around lots of other people who are that way, there's going to be a tendency that's going to creep in where you're going to think that not only is this the ideal, and this is the way things should be, and this is the best outcome for all of society, but you're also almost certainly going to start to think that that is the norm, that that's the center, if you like. And so what happens is, if you are in that situation, and it's a very subtle but powerful thing, and it becomes ingrained in your thinking and your way of looking at the world that, well, this is what the center looks like, and you think that being progressive is actually being in the center or being in the balanced neutral position, then anytime you encounter someone who's center or even center right, you're probably going to mistakenly believe that they're far right, because they are, if you like, more right than of center than you are. But you know, your standard, your balance line is not in the right place. Like if you're measuring 10 centimeters, for example, but you've got zero at the 5 centimeter mark, you are going to think that you are dealing with, 5 centimeters on one side and maybe, I don't know, -5, would we say, on the other. But in actual fact, the zero point's in the wrong place. And if your zero point was back at zero where it should be, then you'd realize, oh, okay, this person who I am judging and measuring to be far right is not actually far right at all. This issue is not far right. The way I report on this issue is going to be different if I have a much clearer and accurate perspective. I think it introduces a much more balanced approach to reporting on things. So this doesn't have to be intentional at all. There doesn't have to be any great conspiracy here. Let's look at the 11 ways in which you can be exposed to bias in the media. The first, and I would say probably now the most devastating and risky, I think, is the headline of a story that you read or that you hear. Generally, this would be stuff that you read in print or online, which is the way in which most people, certainly at first glance, are interacting with their news. It's not probably like it once was, where you would tune into a radio or you would turn on the television to find out about breaking news. Most people, I think, would be going online to find out about breaking news, and where they would regularly see probably most of their news now. And so the headline can be really devastating, because what happens is that a lot of people will only read the headline. It's abundantly clear if you look at any news site that has a social media feed and you look at the comments beneath the story, it's very apparent very quickly that a lot of people are only reading headlines, because it's very common to see comments where people are responding to the headline and not actual content in a story that might give certain perspective or might be completely different to what they've been led to believe in a headline. That's the power of a headline. And it's so powerful because, as I said, it's very common to find that it's the only thing people actually read or engage with about a story. And the other thing that's happening is this: the headline has become even more powerful in the information age, where we are just drowning in a tsunami of information. It's information overload, which is kind of ironic, because when you get information overload, you don't really get good quality of information and you don't get wisdom. As I often like to say to people, we are living in the information age, where we have more information but less wisdom than we've ever had before. And so what's happening is that the media outlets now exist in that age and are working with the tools like social media and the internet, and they're trying to compete and to cut above the rest to get your attention. And so very commonly now, this is why in the last few years this has become a developed trend now, is that you have clickbait headlines from media outlets. They are running headlines which are just, they're deliciously clickbait. It's the only way you can describe them, because they need you to click on the story. The reason they need you to click is because that's how they get their revenue. So in order to seduce you into the click, I've got to give you just enough information to make you want to click, but not enough information so you don't need to click. So that's why you see headlines and social media posts about the stories on a newspaper or a media outlet's social media feeds, where the post and the headline give you little tempters that make you want to click. So I'll give you an example of one that I saw earlier this week about a teacher who was convicted of sexual offending. And so the headline said something like, teacher convicted of sexual offending. Now that headline doesn't tell you, when you click on the story, you find this out, that in actual fact, it's an Australian teacher. Now, if you put Australian in the headline though, and you say Australian teacher convicted of sexual offending, and you're a New Zealand news outlet, which is where I saw this published, people are far less likely to click on that story because it's that's Australia. It's not really got anything to do with us. It's not local. There's no interest. I'm highly unlikely to know this person. So all that kind of stuff, I'm far less likely to click on it. If I'm local and I'm a parent, I'm probably going to think, oh, I better find out what school that was. Was it my school? It's those kind of things that get aroused and make you want to click. It's why you see headlines like, you know, you won't believe what Prince Harry said to the Queen. And they don't tell you what Prince Harry said to the Queen. It's designed to pique your curiosity but not give you too much information. So you actually have to click on the link. You have to click the story to find out more of the juicy details. And we see more and more gossip and other things appearing on what were formerly very reputable news outlets precisely because of this, because it's a very important revenue-gathering tool now. So you've got to have lots of content, lots of salacious content, and you've got to get them clicks happening. And so, as I said to someone recently, the media is engaged in an arms race to the bottom of the brainstem. They're not the only ones, but it's done a huge disservice, and I would say it's a point of destruction for media and done really, really unhealthy things. What this means is that very often people are only reading a headline, and the headline they are reading is deliberately designed to be provocative. So what that means is that you need to read the whole story to understand what it was being provocative about. But if you don't read the whole story and you just read the provocative headline, basically you're getting misinformation a lot of the time, only half the story. And this is a really, really common point of bias. And by the way, you can have a situation where a journalist writes a really good, fair and balanced story, but it's not uncommon for the headline to be written by someone else. And so the person who wrote the headline may load the bias in that the journalist never intended, and they really do a disservice to the journalist and to what would otherwise be a very good balanced story by creating bias in the headline, you know, when the story itself may not ever be read. The second point of potential media bias is what we call burying the lead. And this is where basically the important information in a story is not disclosed early enough or up front. I remember reading an article about 6 months or so ago, I think it was, where a really important piece of information was not found in this story until about three quarters of the way down a lengthy article. And that information was really important. It put really important perspective on the issue at hand and the characters and the players involved. And effectively, it actually completely changed the tone and the perception of things. But it was found three quarters of the way into the story. Now, in that situation, you can say, well, no, we disclosed the relevant facts, but because they were so far down the story, a lot of people just didn't end up reading them. Or by the time they got to them, they were buried in a whole lot of other perception-creating information that had already led the person down a particular rabbit hole before they discovered that they didn't even need to go down that rabbit hole. So burying the lead is another form of bias. Number three type of bias is the volume of stories on a particular issue. So let's imagine that there's a very important bill before your parliament or your politicians, whichever flavour and stripe and country, you know, whichever form of governance you have, but there's a particular important bill before your government and there's a public debate, quote unquote. And I say quote unquote because often we talk about public debates, but now because there's so much bias, I think, in the public presentation of information from the media, we don't really get good debates that often. And also because everything is so truncated, you know, 149 characters or less. There's no real long-form conversations, or certainly not as common as they used to be. And so as a general norm, I think we don't really have good public debate on issues at all. It's very propagandized because it's so superficial, shallow, and speedy. And those three things just don't help good public debate. But let's say there's a bill before your parliament, a very important bill on an important issue. Because, by the way, I should have said that when you're thinking about bias, you really don't need to think about these 11 different types of bias if it's a puff piece that you're reading, you know, about some fireman who saved a kitten from a tree, you know. But important issues, it really matters. And so let's say there's an important bill that's before your parliament, and the particular media outlet runs a series of stories over weeks or months about this particular issue. If 75% of the stories are really in favour of and are pro that particular bill and only 25% are opposed, whether you like it or not, you are not actually getting a balanced perspective and a balanced voice. The issue is not really getting a fair hearing. There's not really genuine dialogue or debate happening there. You are effectively being led in one direction. The fourth type of bias is the presentation, what I'd call presentation of actors in a story. The people who are going to be interviewed effectively. I don't mean they're faking it, and I don't mean they're actors, but the people who will play a role in this particular story. And the way in which they are presented, the tone that is used, whether it's the tone of voice, because, you know, you're actually hearing from the journalist or seeing them on screen, or the words that are used if you're reading about this person to describe that particular person on any given side of an issue. And the tone that is used to introduce people or to talk about people in a story has a huge and very powerful but often very subtle way of actually shaping either a favourable or an unfavourable impression in the reader, the listener, the viewer, the person who's engaging with the media story about that particular person, and therefore about what they're actually about to say. Now, sometimes if a person has done things that show a complete lack of character or are criminal or are immoral, and it's appropriate that those things are part of the story, then, you know, that people's perceptions are going to be shaped. If you've got a good character and a good moral compass yourself, you are rightly going to be reviled or repulsed by things that are just lack all character, that are vices without virtue, that are immoral. That's the natural and good and normal healthy reaction to that. But what I'm talking about here is where you get these things that are unfair character assassination, if you like, of people, an unfair presentation of the people involved, which is a tone that is being set through which you sort of view them and therefore what comes out of their mouth. Number five potential type of bias is emotive imagery. Imagery in general is generally much more powerful. It is a more remembered form of information. Stories are still the best. You know, you remember stories, and narrative information is received generally a lot better than simply dry facts. But images are an extremely powerful tool. They evoke a lot in people that even words will often struggle to do. And so if you've got imagery that goes with a story that, I'll give you an example of this. I was involved in helping in an organization some years ago over an issue with a lot of media coverage was given to this particular issue. And a journalist turned up with a photographer to take a photograph, effectively sort of trying to reenact a situation that had happened. And I told the young woman who was the female spokesperson for this organization, because I was doing media consultancy for them, I said, whatever you do, no matter what they ask you to do, make sure that you smile. Make sure that you smile, because that's what actually had happened in the original situation too. Make sure that you're smiling. And sure enough, when it came time to take the photograph, where they just did this sort of basic reenaction of a very basic everyday scene, three times the journalist retook the photo, and each time they retook it, they tried to get her to stop smiling. Now, the reason for that was if she'd had a more stern look on her face, it would have played into a false perception and a prejudicial perception about her, about the organization, and about what had actually happened. And there was bias there, absolutely. And in this case, it was clearly there was an intent here. Now, it was just amazing, actually. She didn't do that. And each time, she didn't say anything, just held her ground and smiled. So what happened was the final photo that was used with the story was this lovely young woman smiling as this scene, this image is sort of presented to you. And it was very, very powerful. It just disarmed any of the potential prejudice that could have come into the story. So images are extremely powerful. And another thing that can happen in print versions, you know, online versions of stories is you might have, let's go back to the example of a bill that's before your parliament. And so let's say it's a debate about should your flag be changed? You know, should the flag of your country, the current one, be rejected in favour of a new flag, which is just a bright green background and a solitary banana in the middle? And this huge public debate about this, and there's a bill before parliament. And so let's say they're interviewing the anti-flag change group. But then at the top of the anti-flag change group's story, they put a very big image of the pro-flag change group and a very favourable caption and a really appealing image about them before you've even read the story. Already it's starting to create bias in your mind. Just the image itself can actually shape your thinking. Or alternately, they put a very negative and prejudicial image about the anti-flag change group that creates, again, a perception in your mind. It's amazing how this can be done. So it's not uncommon if a particular media outlet is favourable to a cause or a group of protesters, but there's not that many protesters show up to an event. If you tighten up your camera angle, you zoom right in close, you get them bunched together tightly, and you close up that angle and get a very close-up photo, it gives a false perception about how many people were present. Whereas if they've got a group of protesters or an event that they don't like, they're not favourable towards, and they want to create a perception of that, what they will do, and let's say only a small number or even a larger group of protesters showed up, but not huge, what they'll do is you take a wide-angle photograph from further back, and all of a sudden the group looks a lot smaller. It creates perception. Images and imagery are very, very, very powerful tools, and often, you know, the protest one is actually one of the most common ones. You look at an image and you think, wow, it looks like there might have been a whole lot of people there. But in actual fact, if you'd seen the real photo, you would have realised, wow, that's just a very close, tight shot of a group of people. I was at an event once, where a journalist tried to get people to recreate something that hadn't actually happened. And they kept trying to make the group look smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. They were trying to recreate it in a way that was completely false. So after the actual vigil event had happened, and where lots of people had attended, they then asked a much smaller group who were just sitting around talking afterwards to recreate a photo that created a false impression of what happened. So that's a very common thing. It's a very, very powerful form of bias. Number six is there's no opposing voice in a story. So sometimes it might be that, you know, when a story just gets rolling, one person is making the news. So a politician or a group has put out a press release, and to get the issue, the ball rolling, they are interviewed. And so the story may not have an opposing voice yet. But generally, as a general rule, there should be an opposing voice. Unless it's a specific interview piece with just one person, then there should be an opposing voice or voices even in a story, so that you're getting balance. Again, if we go back to the issue of the flag change bill, if the story doesn't actually present critique from both the pro-flag group and the anti-flag change group, then you are not getting a balanced perspective. You're not hearing a balanced voice on that issue. And that is not at all uncommon these days to see. Number seven problem you can have is where you actually have two voices who are two different opposing voices who are present in a story, but there's imbalance in the voices. And so let me give you an example of how this could work. So there's a story about the flag change, and the first thing they do is they interview the pro-flag change spokesperson. And then they secondly interview the anti-flag change spokesperson. Now you've got balance there. So you've got opposing voices, and they've both been given a fair hearing. And then what they do, though, is they go back and for a second time, they interview or they feature commentary from the pro-flag change group, and then they end the story. Now, what's happened there is an imbalance in the voices. And so what's happened is a couple of things. Number one is you've heard one argument presented stronger and more often than the other. One voice is getting more airtime, more podium time than the other voices, and that will shape your perception. Absolutely, there's a bias in that. Not just that, but you've been led on a little journey in that story. It started, first of all, by hearing from the pro flag change group, and then you've gone to hear over the other side of the aisle to hear from the anti flag change group, and then you've been led back again into the pro flag change camp. So what you've got is a story that starts with pro, ends with pro. And so you've been led on a journey that starts you with pro, and it tells you at the end to land on the pro effectively. You're not in a balanced situation there. You're not hearing two voices with equal airtime to an issue at all. And it's a very, very common thing to see. Number eight point of bias is psychological priming. And this is, it can be as simple as a word. One word is all it takes to create psychological priming in a reader or a listener or a viewer. So psychological priming is when you are primed to think a particular way about a person or an issue or an organization, whatever it might be. You are psychologically primed. So before that person has even opened their mouth and said a word, you have already been primed in a particular way to think about them and through a particular lens. I'll give you a really, really common example in mainstream media, because there's a mainstream media, the majority of whom are progressive, they don't realise that, for example, their views on the morality and the ethics of abortion are not actually balanced at all. And so they are wildly pro-choice, often now even pro-abortion in their views. And so what happens is, if you have a story that talks about a pro-life group, that's a fair representation of, you know, who they are. But an unfair one would be to call them an anti-choice group. And first of all, it's unfair in a couple of ways. One is that's not how they describe themselves, and that's not actually what they are at all. And what it does is it creates a negative and false impression. You've been psychologically primed. So someone who's anti-choice in an age of radical individualism and radical autonomy is straight away on the back foot if that's how they've been psychologically primed and presented to a reader, a viewer, a listener. And so it wouldn't be unfair to say anti-abortion, but anti-choice is completely a type of psychological, it's propagandizing. It's not uncommon, particularly on the abortion issue, you see a lot of propaganda in news media coverage of that. Another example would be, and this is a story I saw in the last couple of weeks, if you call something a rumor, that's very different from calling it an allegation. But an allegation and a rumor can be and often are the same thing. And so it's not uncommon to see those words, or they can be used interchangeably in settings, certain settings. And what's interesting is there's a big difference. So if you say that there are allegations being made about someone, that generally is a more neutral stance to take. It's more official. It means that someone has said something, and it needs to be, those allegations for natural justice to be followed should be properly tested, properly and fairly and justly tested in order to perhaps ascertain the truth. But if you say about those same allegations that, you know, rumors are being spread about someone, that's very, very different. And there's a psychological priming that's gone on there that's very different to using the word allegation. Because rumor generally is understood by people as being something that's perhaps malicious, that's possibly even or commonly even false. It's completely unfounded. There's no substance. Rumors and rumor mongering is not a positive thing, but making allegations is a very neutral sort of thing to do. And so it's amazing how you can be primed just, and it's once you see it, you really can't unsee it. You start realizing when you're looking at stories, it's you start to see very quickly where the sort of emotional priming is coming in to an issue. And as I said, it can be as simple as one word. Number nine point of media bias that you encounter is editorializing in a story. So editorials is where you're supposed to editorialize, where you share opinions, and newspaper editors, even journalists do this. There's an interesting debate that went on because once upon a time, and this is very foreign to us, but we didn't even know the name of the journalists who wrote the stories. You might know the newspaper editor, who they were, because they were often a person of note in the community. You'd probably, you know, it wouldn't be uncommon to know the owner. You might know someone was a journalist, but you wouldn't have a byline on a story that said, you know, story by Brendan Malone. And I think there was something really healthy about that state of affairs, where the journalists were not the celebrities and they were not actually even front and center in the story. They were just there to tell the story, and the story was the thing that took front and center. And I think whether we like it or not, and whether you're going to agree or disagree with the merits of having a byline, the simple fact is it did change the nature of reporting, because it changes the relationship that the journalist has with the story and with the public. They are now part of the story. They are now part of, they are now front and center with the public as well. And so there's a sort of a roll-on effect that really started to happen now. And now more and more today, we don't just see and know the names of journalists, but often they are writing editorial pieces as well as actual coverage of stories. And the two are often more and more are morphing into each other, and that is not a healthy thing at all. So editorializing is where you have opinion instead of fact, or fact that is where you have narrative spin that is put onto facts, where you have, you know, supposition and people sort of, you know, guessing at things or making predictions or you know, trying to peer behind the curtain or peer into the crystal ball, rather than just saying here are the facts. And editorializing is a very, very common issue, and it's a common form of bias. And it's amazing how it can creep in, and even just one line of editorializing can be enough to completely upend your view of an issue or a bill or a person. It's amazing how powerful this can actually be. Number 10 form of bias is the introduction of irrelevant information or facts into a story. And usually this will be prejudicial in nature. And so you, let's say the anti-flag change group has a spokesperson or a member who 10 years ago was also part of some other effort that would be some other political movement. I don't know, the movement to ban all bananas in your country. And it was very, very socially unpopular to be part of the anti-banana group. And so what journalists start doing is they keep referencing and introducing that fact that 10 years ago that one of the spokespeople for the anti-flag change group was also formerly part of an anti-banana or pro-banana ban group in your country. And you see, it's actually irrelevant to the issue at hand. It's irrelevant to the merit of their arguments on this issue. It's purely prejudicial. It was fascinating to see this happen in my country. Whenever important ethical or moral issues would come up, one of our previous political leaders, Sir Bill English, the media would immediately start putting the title Catholic in front of his name, because that was his personal religious faith. And so all of a sudden, when it was an abortion issue or the euthanasia debate that happened in our country, he became Catholic Bill English. But on other issues, on economics, he was just plain old-fashioned Bill English. You see what's happening there? That fact is introduced as a prejudicial point. It's actually a prejudice against him, and it's trying to shape your opinions and trying to actually undermine. It doesn't matter what the source is. If a Satanist tells you the truth about something and they are spot on, you should listen to them. If a Christian tells you the truth about something and you're an atheist or a Satanist, they're spot on, you should listen to them. The source, the messenger, is not what you should be doing. You should be looking for the reliability of the information, that you should be looking for truth. Now, yes, sometimes an unreliable messenger, you should have skepticism about. That is absolutely for sure. But more and more we see prejudicial things that have got nothing to do with a person's reliability or character, but instead are being introduced. And they're relevant informational facts, but they create a prejudice in a story, a bias. And number 11, the final type of bias that you can be exposed to is the opposite of that, and that's the failure to disclose relevant facts or information. And so a story is written and it leads you on a journey, and by the end of it, you think you've got everything you need to know, and you're starting to shape an opinion about this, and a public perception is being created, but in actual fact, an important fact has been left out of that story or some relevant information. And so all of a sudden that would completely change, whether it might be to create a little bit of a firewall of skepticism. So let's say that you discover that the pro flag change organization is being led by a man who works for a flag manufacturing company, and they stand to make billions of dollars when everyone has to destroy their old flags and replace them and buy new flags. And so this person is a flag distributor, and they stand to make a lot of money off this. And so that, I'd say that's a relevant piece of information you probably want to know. You might say, well, they might still be right, but there's certainly a bit more of a firewall of skepticism I'm going to have. I'm going to have to filter information through that now. A failure to disclose, for example, an important piece of information. I saw a story the other day about businesses here in New Zealand who are rather frighteningly are talking about trying to demand vaccination, forced vaccination in order to enter their premises. So you'd have to have a certificate that says, I am one of the vaxxed, I am one of the clean, and I am allowed into this establishment, and the unclean are obviously not allowed in. And what was interesting was that the story, and this is in the current environment with COVID and everything else, any time there's COVID reporting, I've noticed that the media have usually gone out of their way, particularly if someone's presenting a counter view or they're questioning official policy, they've gone out of their way to make sure that the reader knows, this fact here or this fact there, in opposition to what that person's saying. And what was missing from the story about vaccine passports was a really important fact and very relevant, and that is the fact that people can still contract and transmit the virus even if they're vaccinated. Now, that has a huge bearing on whether or not you should even embark down this course of action, because if there's no advantage for vulnerable people, or there's no advantage to you, like it doesn't reduce transmissibility. For example, if you're in a room full of vaccinated people versus unvaccinated, if there's still a high chance you can contract it or it can be spread, then a vaccine passport doesn't really do its job if you're claiming it's a safety tool. So it's important that important information is actually disclosed. Relevant facts are presented and put on the table. And often what happens instead is you get a jaundiced view of this thing where facts are not disclosed, things are hidden, and as a result, people's perceptions are wrongly shaped. And it's amazing how people can be misinformed very, very easily about issues. So there you go, 11 different forms of media bias that we can be easily subjected to on a daily basis, and something I think to be aware of when you're engaging with any media content, doesn't matter the source, whether that's your favourite or one that you're suspicious of, actually look and discern and be discerning listeners, watchers and readers. And have a think next time you're engaging with media stories. Just stop and have a little look and say, am I actually being primed? Am I being conditioned? Am I being led to think about a particular issue? Is there emotionalism here instead of substance? Is there emotionalism which is designed to distract or create a perception within me regardless of what else is in the story? I think it's really, really important that we approach the information we're receiving from the media with that discerning eye if we truly want to be people who are properly and well-informed about actual issues. And one other piece of advice I would give is, I think I said this on a previous episode, make sure that you measure twice and cut once. So don't just read only one side or listen to only one voice in an issue. Try and get both sides or read multiple sources to try and get a... And particularly if a news outlet's referring to a particular event or a story or a pamphlet or a website or whatever, go and click on that website. Go and look for the pamphlet, the study, the story, whatever it is. Find the original thing and actually see what was said and see whether or not the reporting actually matches up or whether there's been a bit of misinformation going on there. I think, as I said, it's the only way to be actually truly and properly informed, or as best you possibly can, and to reduce the risk of going off with only half of the information and being more ignorant than actually informed about the issues that really matter. Thanks for tuning in. You guys are awesome. I will see you next time on The Dispatches. The Dispatches podcast is a production of Left Foot Media. If you enjoyed this show, then please help us to ensure that more of this great content keeps getting made by becoming a patron of our work at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time on The Dispatches.